Welcome to the TRI Research Group podcast, the latest in palliative care and end-of-life research.
We have Dr. Deborah Raphael, who is a researcher with the TRI Group. So today we're going to talk about one of your publications that you undertook as part of your PhD, and it's an article that was published in the European Journal of Cancer Care, and it's called The Nature and Timing of Distress Among Post-Treatment Hematological Cancer Survivors. And so I just wonder if you can tell us a little bit about this publication and what's behind it all.
Okay, so this was the first study I undertook. Mm-hmm. So it was the qualitative phase of my project. So it was about, you know, there was not a lot done in cancer survivorship for hematological cancers. I found in my review there was 7 articles that looked at post-treatment cancer survivors or hematological cancer survivors. So then I thought, you know, we have to look at, so what is actually happening for these people, because there wasn't a lot to go on. So I basically interviewed people who were within 5 years post-treatment, and they had to be in remission, because I think if you're currently being treated, it makes things a lot different.
It was really interesting because I remember us sitting next to each other at our desks talking right at the very beginning of your research ideas.
Yeah.
And we had this conversation about, you know, how do you define survivor? Because there are some hematological malignancies where they'll have treatment for a very long time and be in remission, whatever that might mean. So tell us a little bit how you defined that.
It had to be clinically defined. So it had to be if the hematologist told that they were in remission and they weren't receiving any treatment. Mm-hmm. Maintenance treatment would have been okay, but most people, they were receiving no treatment. So they were basically having follow-ups, but, yeah, they weren't receiving any treatment. So I think that was an important distinction, because I think if you're, because the treatments can be so aggressive, if you're currently in the middle of it, you're going to be feeling very different to someone who's not being treated.
It's really, I'm going to go off track a little bit, and we'll get back to your publication, but I was in a meeting the other day with a hematologist, no, she's an oncologist. We were talking about survivorship and how you define it, and there's a new swell of opinion about survivorship not necessarily being about remission or cure, that you're a survivor even if you have disease that doesn't respond to treatment.
Yeah,
because you're surviving the whole experience.
Yeah, there's definitely different definitions, and you'll find in a lot of publications about survivorship that includes their definition is from diagnosis. So my distinction was post-treatment survivorship, because my goal was to look at people who had been discharged from treatment. So, you know, when you're being treated and you've got all of these people around them, because it's quite frequently a really intensive treatment, and then all of a sudden they're like, okay, see ya, you're in remission now, so you're all good. We'll see you later at the next follow-up. So that was what I was interested in, because I think often people, whether they may be discharged from hospital in general or from surgery, are often left feeling like they don't really know what's going on and what, when they should be worried or when they shouldn't be worried. And that was what interested me, because I think, you know, it's such a huge thing to go through, such a huge thing on your body. And I think psychologically, and you're suddenly left, and you really, there's not really anyone there that you feel like you can call on when you need to. So that was the rationale behind it. And I think in this phase, that's kind of what I found, is that people came out the end of it and thought, oh wow, you know, what now? You know, and a lot, and some people, you know, someone said they were like my family, the hospital, because everybody generally spoke glowingly of all the what they received, the care they received in hospital. It's just when they came out the other side of it, they suddenly felt like there was nobody they could call when they were worried about things.
So tell us a little bit about your sample. So these people that had years of treatment, months of treatment, so they had a long-standing relationship with the hospital service?
It varied, because it was all hematological cancers. So, you know, acute leukemias, some of them that could be treated for a year. Some of the lymphomas, I think they had treatment for 6 months. So it really varied. So, yeah, it was at least 6 months.
Did you recruit them? How did you identify them?
Through the cancer registry.
Right, yeah.
So I had the register of all hematological cancers within, I think, about a 5 or 6 year period to recruit from. So I think the biggest thing that came out of it really was there was no key person that they really felt like they could contact. I think if you think about it, because a lot of people had worries about recurrence, obviously, because, you know, they tell you the highest chances to come back are within 5 years. And so every time they had any little symptom like, oh, you know, is my hair falling out? Is that a lump?
Mm. So they were much more sensitive to what was happening in their body.
A lot of symptom checking, like they'd be in the shower and think, oh, that's just swelling under my armpit. And, you know, and then, of course, there's that the complex side of that where a lot of people don't have any symptoms. You know, a lot of the chronic leukemias that's picked up in a random blood test or even myeloma sometimes. And they're like, hold on, I didn't have any symptoms beforehand, so how do I know now that it's not back? So they become very hyper aware about anything that feels potentially off in their body, and should they be worried. But it's in those situations where they don't really know who they should speak to. So I think in many cases, the GP's not really in the loop when it comes to their treatment. So it's kind of, they don't feel like they can speak to their GP because they think, well,
especially if they've had a long treatment period, they've been treated for a whole year, they may not have seen their GP, and then it's go back to your GP. But do they have that relationship or that level of trust or even the perception of expertise?
Someone actually said, you know, what do they know? I mean, they're not a hematologist. And it's fair enough because they think, you know, a GP has got a really good broad knowledge of everything, but they're not hematologists, so they're not going to have that expertise that people are looking for. So it's a really hard situation to be in, I think, in terms of physical symptoms, thinking, who do I talk to and should I be worried? And I'm not sure. But also the psychological aspects of it and the psychosocial aspects of it, there's really nothing. There's really nothing. No one that most people felt they could talk to about it. And in some cases, which I think was the saddest, I think, is that people didn't feel like they even had friends and family to talk to, you know.
So they're quite alone in that experience?
Well, they had friends and family, but they felt like some people feel like they don't want to burden people or that people don't really understand. And some have spouses who they don't feel like they can talk to about it. Sometimes because they don't want to worry them, but sometimes because they just don't get that level of understanding. And a lot of people think that once you're being told you're in remission, it's a signal to dance for joy and you're all better. But actually people are left feeling a bit shell-shocked. And a lot of their loved ones, you know, well, not a lot, but there's a certain amount that say, well, just get on with it. You're cured. You know, what are you worried about? You've been through it. You should be fine now and you should be back to normal and getting on with life. But people are thinking, I don't know how to do that, and I don't feel like I can just jump back into things because I feel like a different person.
So some of your sample was, how long had they been?
Some up to 5 years.
Right.
Some, it was between a year and 5 years. I don't think I had anyone within the first year.
Right.
But yeah, so it'd all been at least 1 year post-treatment.
And you noticed similar responses to people that, you know, because there's that period of adjustment, isn't there, that people might have a different response to that, you know, being discharged from a service, and then this period of adjustment and then finding a new way of being in the world. Did you see that same level of aloneness with their survivorship, with people who were close to the five-year mark as well?
Some people. I had one person who was still very upset and actually cried through the entire interview. She was still so traumatised by it. And she was somebody who had said to me, I've never spoken to anybody about this. And she's so actually psychologically
quite
traumatised by the experience.
And she was quite a long way post.
Yeah, 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And, yeah, so definitely. And I noticed it too, sort of segueing into my second phase, really. But there was no significant difference in distress between 1 and 5 years.
Wow.
So
I think, you know, other research shows that, you know, logically it starts to tail off a bit the further you get from it, but not always. Mm. It's not this natural progression from post-treatment to as it goes past that I automatically, you know, 5 years plus, you'll start feeling better because it doesn't...
Well, it's a very individual response, isn't it, around trauma in your life. And yeah, that's possibly, I guess, what you're saying. So what now? So what needs to happen? I mean, do you get a sense from your participants about what was required?
I think, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm looking at next is interventions. So looking at what actually works and what would work within our house system. I think there needs to be, I don't know, a service. There needs to be something or within a service that deals specifically with post-treatment survivors because there are some organisations like Cancer Society and Leukaemia and Blood for New Zealand but they only have limited resources and limited services because they're all, you know, they're not funded by the government mostly. Mm. So, yeah, it's definitely about having something in place that people, even if there was just a dedicated phone line, that would be a good start. It's just having something there that people can turn to, that people know about when they need it. Because not everybody needs it.
Mm.
You know, many people do finish treatment and just get on with it and they don't need extra support. But I find the people that do, there's just nothing there.
We also wonder about the psychological morbidity if we don't pick up those people that really do need it and the impact eventually that will have on our healthcare system anyway.
Yeah.
If we don't pick up those people that struggle.
Yeah, and there's lots of research that shows that people who do have high distress are less likely to comply with treatment if they ever, and there's lots of follow-on from that. Besides the association between psychological health and physical health anyway, people are not likely to want to go through it again, so it's going to have a huge impact physically as well.
And I guess the impact that also has on relationships, you know, that the person who had the illness, the relationships with other people in their lives and stuff like that as they struggle to cope with the trauma of...
Yeah, it's really interesting because a lot of people, you would think that it would be something that maybe brings people closer, but it seemed to be a thing that actually brought out a lot of conflict, I guess you could say, where people didn't feel like they were getting the support from their family. And I think that was really distressing for people because you'd think, you know, I have cancer and the people in their family that I guess that they thought would support them didn't. So that was just another thing to add to their
struggles. I always wonder, you know, having been working in, you know, palliative care and clinically for a long time, is that there's nothing more lonely than being the ill person, no matter how close you are to your family or your friends, and it's not necessarily a sign of a bad relationship. It's a really lonely place to be because nobody knows what it's like to be ill, apart from the person who's ill.
Yeah, and I think that's why people, many people I spoke to wanted to talk to people who'd been through it.
Yeah.
And the chances to do that were not there really, because the groups that they have for, they do have groups that, you know, you can go post-treatment, but many of them are actually just with everybody. So I'd had somebody who said, you know, I was in a group with someone who was terminal. And so the facilitator said, let's all go around and say what we'd like to do before we die. And this person's like, I've just gone into remission and I'm like wanting to celebrate the fact, you know, but now I'm being asked to talk about what might happen if
different
I die.
Different agenda, isn't it?
Yeah.
Different people.
That was really confronting. And yeah, it was like, I never went back to that. That was actually quite traumatic for me because I was actually like, I don't want to have to think about that.
Yeah.
And then again, a lot of groups don't, they'll have multiple cancers. So, and hematological cancers are
quite diverse, aren't
they? They're quite different.
Yeah.
The treatment tends to be, as a whole, like more aggressive than a lot of other cancers. So it's kind of like, you know, you had a lump removed and it's over. I've been through a year. I've been in stem cell transplant and, you know, endless chemo, and they want people who can relate to what they've been through.
Mm.
And they don't. There's not always that opportunity either. So there wasn't a lot of option in terms of psychological support.
Mm.
Was the main thing, really. And then having no clue as to who they would ask for it. So that's what we need to fix.
Great. Well, it's really interesting. And just to remind the people listening is that this was published in 2018 in the European Journal of Cancer Care. And the link to the article will be on our introduction.
Yeah.
If people want to get a copy of the article. And we'll be interviewing Deborah again to hear about her phase two work. Oh, and there is one question that we do ask everybody. Yes. I hope you've had a think about this.
Mm.
The question is, being a good palliative and end-of-life care podcast, is the old bucket list question, but a little bit different in that we want you to tell the listeners what, if you had 24 hours left on this planet, what's the one thing that you would do?
It's hard because the bucket list one was, I was thinking I would like a white Christmas, but it might be a bit hard to fit in.
Well, in 24 hours, yeah. Especially in New Zealand.
In summer. And I think it's probably everyone says the same thing, but I think I would probably just want to be with my family.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd want to do anything in particular, depending how sick I was. I mean, if I was still able-bodied, I might want to throw bungee jump or something.
Well, this is all hypothetical. If we could give you a white Christmas in 24 hours with your family and a bungee jump, then so be it.
Yeah, perfect.
A bungee jump in snow. Yeah, I'm not sure that's even allowed. Anyway, thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing the next step of your research.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you for listening to our podcast today. If you would like to know more about TRI, please go to our website. The link is in the description.